The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Good evening and welcome, everyone. I'm really delighted to introduce tonight's guest Dharma teacher, Nicole Terras. Did I say your last name right?
Yeah.
Nicole has been coming to Common Ground for about 10 years, since 2005. And subsequently, Nicole has become a leader in our community. And from time to time, giving Dharma talks, as she is going to do tonight. Nicole has been especially a leader in the area of inclusivity, and she is on the advisory council related to inclusivity work at Common Ground. And she is also, I think, a very wise lover of animals, and she's also a leader in the community about relating to animals in non-harming, wise way. So here's Nicole.
Hi, everybody. Can everyone hear me okay? Just tell me if you can't. I have a very quiet voice, and tonight it's not very good anyway, so just let me know if you can. So thank you for coming. I know it's beautiful outside, and I had a lot of competition with fun events for the summer tonight. You're all missing the Internet Cat Video Festival, which a bunch of our friends went to, so thanks. But anyway. So when we started meditating, I asked you to please think about the question, how do you know that you're alive? And I'm just wondering if anyone had any feeling about that or anything that they'd be willing to share on that question. Yes. Hi.
And so whenever choice, that choice gives people freedom, and I know I'm alive because I have those moments of freedom, or in those moments of freedom, I know I'm alive.
Thank you.
Sometimes I just have awareness that I'm kind of playing a script.
Trying to be alive. Trying to be alive. Anybody else?
My name's Janie, and I guess off of that same vein, I feel most alive when I'm not in my thinking, kind of like ego mind, when I'm just kind of like, okay, I'm not telling stories about like what happened yesterday or what will happen. It's just kind of like when I'm actually like just present and enjoying what's happening and being connected with other people. Right. That's when I feel most alive.
Thank you.
I was not convinced that I was alive. And I guess the reason the way I got to that was it felt as though I could feel sensation as though it was being acted upon me. So that I would say, is this wetness necessarily coming from me? Like, is it possible this is just some wet thing that was here? And I was a dead leaf or something. So, you know, I think it might be a concept that we associate a living with what we know that we are living. But if we didn't know that we weren't living, then maybe these sensations wouldn't be telling us this is life. So that's where I'm at.
Okay. Oh, Lewis?
Like you, I don't know for sure. What came up for me is what I understand to be the animal process of breathing. I know that I'm doing that, or I feel confident anyway. And the other thing that came up was that to me, being alive is something about being dreamed. Like I'm in a dreaming process that maybe I didn't initiate.
Okay. Well, thank you. Do you want to just put that down somewhere for a little bit? Unless someone else wants to have something. If you put your hand up really high, if you're on the sides. Okay. So the reason I asked that was, you know, just to focus attention on the feeling of being alive, but also I was curious what you guys would come up with. And I've been contemplating that myself a lot lately in my practice. And I've been studying Buddhism since the early 1990s. And the Buddha is all about, you know, there's a lot of words about body, attention to your body, posture. It's really important. A lot of the practices are about how you hold your body, how you use your body, how you breathe, how you pay attention. It's very body focused. And so as someone with a disability, which I've had for my whole life, coming into Buddhism and hearing all of the talking about body, first of all, the practices, I couldn't ever really do them the way that they're supposed to be done. I mean, I can't sit in any kind of cross-legged position or anything else. And so it made it a little bit, you know, I had to adapt, and obviously you can meditate in a chair, but it's always this sense of adaption. And I've noticed lately that that sense of adaption puts me out of my body. And because I'm always trying to make it do or, you know, approximate what I'm supposed to do instead of just letting it be what it is. And so I started to notice that just with my very meditation practice lately. And so then I was feeling that way, and then I realized, you know, the reason I came to Buddhism was to find freedom from suffering, psychological suffering. I wasn't here for my body. I wasn't trying to get help for that. I wanted to be able to feel more alive and more awake in my world and more connected to others and to myself. And so I've focused that direction for a long time, but I realized that my body was always like this exception. So when I decided to do the talk here tonight, I felt like I was going to do a different topic, one that I know more about, like compassion or something simple like that. But then I was like, well, I should really do mindfulness of the body because that is what I really don't know a lot about. And that is what I'm learning. It's so vital because all the other practices rest on that. That's the core of practice, is being able to be, as far as I understand right now anyway, being able to be in the body, grounded and feeling safe. And so I was in a March Buddhist Studies this last period, and it was on mindfulness of the body. And one thing he said really surprised me, and it was just in the very beginning, he was talking about the need to, you know, embody your body, and that if you were able to really be calm and at ease in the body, then you would be able to feel a great sense of ease and a great sense of presence, and that this is the way to that sense of ease and presence. And when he said that, I was struck, because I knew that I knew that I had experienced that. And then I suddenly realized that I have actually had moments of ease in my body, and how different those moments feel to an average moment or most moments in my life where I don't feel really connected. And so then I realized that this whole body topic did have to do with me, and I wasn't the exception, because talking to all of you tonight is very strange for me, because I'm, like I said, I've been disabled since birth. So I always had the feeling that I was different, that I didn't belong, that my body wasn't good, it wasn't viable, it wasn't the same as other people's. And so I set myself apart. And so it's just for me to come and even bring this up. It's like, I feel like I'm admitting that I have a body, which is sort of strange, but that's like, just like you, I do too. So I've done a lot it's really, a lot of religions that I've studied as well, talking about transcending the body, or the body is not us. And I've done that and just really noticed that I don't feel as full of peace if I'm doing that sort of practice than in the body. So even though the body is a really sort of difficult place to be for me, I'm starting to really appreciate how it's a center point of that natural state of ease. So, let's see. So then I've been just contemplating a lot of different thoughts on this that I wanted to chat with you guys about, and then hopefully we can all talk together too. But one thing is, I've been thinking about my relationship to my body, and it's like this part that we're partners, right? So I feel like I have this sense I own my body. This is me. I'm my body. But really, I've thought about that, and I was thinking, really, how does that work? Because I'm not beating my heart right now. I don't even know the digestive processes, the brain, how I'm making myself talk. You know, all of this is happening for me. And it's all happening for me silently. I don't have to do anything. It's like this organism in itself taking care of me. And we're both working together for survival, right, to live in this world. The only way to be here is to have a body. And so I have to have this body form in order to be able to experience life. But the body form is really I'm not sure how to think about it, but it begins to feel like it's this piece of nature that needs to be taken care of. And like the tree in my backyard, it's like, this is my part of the universe that was given to me when I was born. And I feed it, I listen to it, I do what it needs, I sleep when it needs, and I try to take care of it, and in turn, it takes care of me. And so when I think of it that way, I feel a sense of compassion toward my body that I didn't used to feel. And I think that part of it is because with body issues like pain or I have a lot of body issues. My body doesn't function very much, but it has, with all these things, it's really hard to feel comfortable and with the body and not be mad at it. So, you know, like even tonight, I was having some trouble breathing last night and I was just mad at my body, like, really, you're going to make me miss my talk? And I'm going to be really mad, you know, and you're going to do it. You better just breathe. And, you know, and I realize I'm having this conversation with my body, like, okay, it's not a very healthy relationship. If I had a friend that was saying, I have to do this, but I don't feel good, I probably wouldn't say, shut up, you're going to do it. You know, yeah. Don't tell me about this. I'll talk to you about it in 2 days. You know, whatever. And I wouldn't do that to my friend. So I just started to realize, you know, I drive my body that way, and I do a lot with a very little amount of strength. And so I drive my body really hard. And it would be nice if I appreciated it for putting up with me all these years. Because it's put up with a lot of abuse and a lot of neglect and a lot of denial. And so, anyway, that's just one element of just trying to relax into the body and have compassion and more of a soft sense about it instead of being mad all the time, but it's not what is easy for me. You know, it would be a lot easier for me if my body was all of a sudden strong. But obviously, it's not able to do that. So, so that's sort of like my personal story about that. And one thing I wanted to bring to the bigger topic tonight is how when, you know, our ability to fit in to society and to feel that we belong and that we're safe with other people is very important to how much we're able to be inside of our bodies. And it's, see, I wrote down something I said I was going to read. So there's so many social judgments, you know, there's so many conditions that a body in the world today is supposed to live up to. It's supposed to be a certain race, it's supposed to be a certain gender, it's supposed to be a certain strength, it's supposed to have all sorts of things. We have very limited ideas of what we value in terms of the appearance of someone's body and what's valuable and what's not valuable. And so, like for me, I was very young when I was diagnosed. I was born disabled, but they didn't know until I was almost 2. And so I remember, it's a very early memory, but it was very unexpected, the diagnosis. And I remember my status changing in my family. So I was the first born, I was the first grandchild, I was very spoiled, you know, and very, entertained. And then all of a sudden, my family found out that I had this disease and I would never walk. And at that time, they didn't think I would live to be 5. And so all of a sudden, everyone was just, I became a different person. And my mom became afraid to bond to me. And I had a wheelchair all of a sudden. And so everyone in public treated me different. And I had sort of this, it was very obvious, but I didn't know how to think about it, the switch from being a member of society to being something pitiful. as a little child in a wheelchair is just, oh my gosh, that's not okay. So people were very condescending toward me, and a lot of my life changed right then. So I noticed that, you know, that was very obvious thing, but it happens to all of us in our own way, and there's some way that we're afraid that we don't belong. And it could be in a larger social group, it could be in our families or in our communities, right here at Common Ground. There's always a fear of rejection. And part of that is because humans are social animals. We're just, we think we're individuals, but I don't think we are. We're social animals, and so we're like birds and pets of dogs and herds of horses. We, in order to survive, we stay together. And our place in our society, our pecking order, determines our safety. We have to have a place, we have to have a purpose and a value and the other people that love us to take care of us. And then we all take care of each other. And this is how it's, you know, works in the animal kingdom. And this is how it's supposed to work in the human world. But we have this idea of so many different categories that you have to fit into in order to be accepted. So I think it's really interesting that there's a lot of studies going on right now, and just in regular psychology talking about this. So this is actually a quote from a book called Healing Sex, A Mind-Body Approach to Healing Sexual Trauma by Stacey Haynes. And she says, the human psychobiology is oriented towards two things, survival and connection. Survival is a deep drive to be and remain alive. Connection is about being loved and loving, being accepted by the group, and being able to contribute to other people. We are social animals, and at the very biological level, we orient towards connection and making meaning with others. And I couldn't find a better way to explain that, how important it is that we feel that we belong. I have to switch my pages. So I wanted to do this little experiment with you guys now. So it doesn't require you to talk to anyone, but if you would you just look around you and find your nearest unfamiliar face? And just look at your nearest unfamiliar face. Hopefully everyone doesn't know everybody. Okay, does everybody have someone? Okay. And then just remember what that person looks like. Close your eyes for a minute, maybe. Just imagine them. And then imagine that this person that you don't know is coming up to talk to you. And you want to greet them well. And now, what assumptions do you feel that this person may be making about who you are just based on your appearance? Maybe it's something you're wearing. What image are you trying to project about your identity and how your identity projects towards others? Like for myself, I would assume people approaching me would think, oh, she's in a wheelchair, what do I do? And that's my first assumption of others' assumptions. Then they might think, oh, those are really nice earrings, at least. You know, whatever. But just listen to the thoughts that will come up in your head. What would this person think of you? And are most of those thoughts positive or negative? Or are they neutral? how likely do you think this person's assumptions, which of course are really your own assumptions, are to be true or untrue in relation to who you really are? Okay. So I wanted to do that just to see, and I hope it worked for some people, like what kinds of things come up. It's really hard when people are actually approaching to be conscious of those sort of defenses. Like for me, if I have someone come up to me and talk to me, and I just know, it's not that I have to think it through. It's just my way of relating is to know that a lot of people, especially people that don't know me, are going to see my chair, and that's all they're going to see at first. And so I deal with that. But it can be very subtle. I have a lot of friends who are physically, you know, fit the norm of what they, you know, the value norm. And so, but they always have some body part that they're ashamed of, you know. Maybe it's their finger, maybe it's their nose, or whatever. It's like there's always something that it's like, oh, I hope they're not noticing my pimple or something. And it's just so, it's interesting, but it's really sad to think about how we do that to ourselves and how we're so afraid of being judged by other people. And then when that happens, like for me, I know when that happens, I immediately find myself out of my body. Like there is no way I'm going to be in my body and feel the full impact of someone's judgments of me. And so it's an automatic response to sort of live outside my body. I have this sense of my center of gravity being kind of out here somewhere, not back here. So I'm kind of out here trying to hide behind something. So just think about that and see if any of that makes sense for you. So it's really painful how to think of whether we belong and how other people see us. And discrimination is a type of trauma. And there are unrecognized impacts of homophobia, sexism, racism, and other types of social oppression. And those are especially, obviously, against people who are different, but they affect all of us. If we are judging someone else or putting them as an other, then we're also not accepting that part of ourselves. And so we're not letting other people in, we're not letting ourselves in. And when we're in this mindset of always categorizing ourselves and others, then there's a lot of conditioning that operates in us without us knowing, and we may hurt ourselves or someone else without trying. Now, one thing I do a lot here with the inclusivity work, and so I've heard a lot about the implicit bias tests that are online that you can take to see what your social conditioning is like around different marginalized groups. So you can take it for people of color, or different religions, or different people's disability. And there's probably 10 categories in all different races listed. So I did about 5 of them. But I was afraid to do it at first because I thought, I don't want to know that really I'm a racist. Like, I don't want to know. So I don't want to take an online test that says, you failed. You are a racist. So I decided to start with the easy one. So I chose disability. Because I thought, I'm not against disabled people, obviously, right? So I did the disability one first. And it was really amazing how hard it was. And it was really amazing that my test result, or whatever, my survey result, was that I am very ableist. And I strongly prefer people who are able-bodied over people who are disabled. And I was like, holy crap, you know. For sure, I'm going to fail all the other ones. So then... So anyway, I took the other ones, and actually on all, I took probably four or five, and with different races and different religions and whatnot. And I was non-biased on all of those. And so it was, I realized that, yeah, I don't judge people being, it's not a big part of my life to judge people based on their race or based on their religion or based on their economic class. But I judge myself every minute based on my disability. And so even though I am an advocate, I have a lot, most of my really good friends are disabled. And obviously, I live in the world, it's really hard to not have just learned that, that this is bad and not being able to associate good words with disability. So that was very eye-opening. And then I was listening to a talk, and I heard Desmond Tutu. I started about Desmond Tutu, and he was talking about implicit bias and how hard it is for any of us to to not be affected and hurt or wounded by the conditioning of our society. And so Desmond Tutu was apparently flying on a plane out of Nigeria. When he boarded the plane, he was really happy because he saw there were two black pilots. And it was the first time he'd ever seen two black pilots. And so he was very proud of that and very happy to see that. But then during the flight, they encountered some turbulence. And at that moment, Desmond Tutu admits, the first thought that came to my mind was, hey, there's no white man in that cockpit. Are those blacks going to be able to fly the plane? And he saw himself say that and believe that and panic by that. And that's how it is. It's so deeply rooted, so deeply rooted. So this is kind of like the pain that the body holds, and hold a lot of pain about who we are, our identity, if we're lovable, if we fit in, who we are to others, whether we're worthy of being taken care of. All of this sort of rests as a pressure in the body to sustain us and our position in this world. And it's, you know, it's something that it really affects the sense of safety and the sense of, like, when I try to go into my body, is it safe to do that? Or do I need to stay out here and be someone else? Because being in the body would be being me, and that might not be enough, you know? And so that's what these core beliefs are about. That we learn through our lives about ourselves, and that keep us out of our body. So let me see here. I always write notes and I never follow them. So, your turn, yes. Do the next one, too. So in the last few minutes, I wanted to have us be more interactive with each other, because I want to hear from you guys too. I'm actually learning about this, so you know, I'd love to have discussions about it. So one thing that I was thinking would be fun is if we were to investigate our core beliefs with each other. You know, what kind of things do we believe about ourselves that keep us out of our body? And I thought my core beliefs were really bad, but then I was reading this article that Mark sent out, actually, from Charlotte Jochel Beck, and it's from an essay called Our Substitute Life. And she says, and she's talking about the core beliefs and how how they operate in us unconsciously a lot of the time. So she's naming the beliefs. So she says, it becomes a truth we hold so deeply that it is not even open to question. I am unlovable. I am hopeless, worthless. I am alone, abandoned. I am unable to succeed. I am unable to do it right. I am separate from the rest of humanity. And so when we have this operating, she says, you know, we might look like we're doing really well in the world, like someone like me, an overachiever, that I'm trying to cover up this core belief that I have to be really great because otherwise I'm not at all. And so it's like fueled by this shame and not just fueled by this confident intention. And so she says, a few more core beliefs. She says, so if I'm pushing myself to succeed or to do something, it's because it might be operating in me that I feel that I'm unable to succeed. I'm an imposter. I never was any good. If they really knew the truth about me, I don't deserve to live. And now I did not write that, but those are my core beliefs. So I don't know. I'm like, geez, I can't believe someone else thought that way. But it's really, really sad to think that. And in this article, she believes that everyone has this to some degree. And just thinking about that is so humbling, you know? And that we can believe these things about ourselves so strongly that no one can talk me out of it. So my friend has said, but I love you, you're wonderful, you're perfect, you're beautiful, you're great, you know? It's like, yeah. Okay? Okay, well, I'll talk to you later. So... anyway, so I wanted to split into groups of three and then have you guys each spend like maybe 3 minutes each person and talk about maybe any of these core beliefs that struck you about yourself, how they might be operating in your life, or any other one that you may feel. What is this sort of... painful self-belief that keeps you out of your body when you notice that you're not fully being here, especially in relation to other people. So trying to relate to other people and then feeling like, oh, they're not going to want me, or that type of feeling. What drives that? So we'll do 3 minutes each person. And then... let's see, I don't do math very well. Okay, and then we'll come back here and talk in the big group about how it went. Okay? Is there any questions? Is that clear, sort of? Will you just choose someone? I don't know how to count like Mark does. definitely choose three groups of three. If you are, please choose people that you don't know. But just some people near you. Thank you, everybody, for coming back to us. I'm just wanting to open it up here at the end and see how everyone's doing, if there's anything that you're willing to share about the talk tonight or your group experience, any thoughts or anything that affected you before we end. Yes.
What you said about yourself and what are people's assumptions when they see me. I work with people who are at least 15 to 20 years younger than me. I work on the phone, but I sometimes actually see them. And what I have to do is I realize, oh my gosh, I'm going to meet these people. So how do I help them not notice that I'm 20 years older than they are? So I walk in that room and I spend the entire time prior to that focusing totally on the impression my body is given. Are they going to notice my skin? Are they going to notice the color of my hair? Are they going to notice, you know, what am I going to do? I can't cover my hands, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought, based on what you said, I thought, what would happen if I didn't have that? You know, if I didn't go in there worrying about pretending that I wasn't 20 years older or ignoring or denying it and just was there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I'll just throw out something real quick. You go in that room and maybe you think, everyone's thinking, oh, I look a little old. But chances are, being a little bit younger person, being more like, wow, this is a wise, more mature sort of person. This is something to learn from right now. So maybe you feel that intimidation from somebody younger. Maybe the younger person feels a little intimidation. You go too.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, thank you for saying that, because it reminds me to add, you know, the assumption exercise, they're not always true. And we have reasons that we think they're true. Like, you have reasons that you think they might judge you for that. But it may or may not be true. And so one thing that's helped me work with that, especially when I start to notice, oh, I think this person's judging me because I'm disabled. They think I'm not an intelligent person. And then I notice that, and then it may or it may not be true. I don't know for sure. You know, and I'm not going to be dumb about it and say, oh, no, I'm sure it's not true. But on the other hand, it's good to always leave that possibility. You know? Yes.
You say that, I was having trouble focusing on it. I kept thinking, well, I was really more focused on you, like on getting to, you know, I just couldn't really, what I'm presenting, I just couldn't really relate to it. I mean, I know in certain parts of my life I could, certain times, but right now I just felt a little like, that's not where I'm at when I walk into a space to meet somebody. It has more to do with calling forth what it is about you that I wanna know, and being curious about that. And I remember I worked on this assiduously when I was like 19, because I was really struck by beauty, and I used to not be able to look at men that were attractive, and really, so I was like, well, that doesn't seem very nice to them, because they'll never get anybody to relate to them because they're the beautiful people. So I remember like going up to people that I found sort of attractive and saying to myself, like, well, I'd start to fall away and I'd go, but who are you? Mm-hmm. Inside, and then I would talk to them, and then it would start to happen, and I'd go, and who are you? Mm-hmm. And I would just kind of call myself to come out, and to come look.
Yeah.
It's so fun. And so, anyway, that's,
yeah.
It's not that it isn't valuable to figure out what inhibits us, but I think sometimes the best way to uninhibit ourselves is to ask ourselves stuff that get us outside. That's my thoughts.
You just seem like you
fine, I'll talk.
He just seems like he needs it, right?
Yeah. right. On those sorts of veins, I guess. It was funny in our group. We all talked about what Nicole brought up as a prompt, sort of for the group thing, and with the core beliefs that we have inside of being, worthless or unlovable, and that is something that I deal with and been looking at lately. And we all three talked about it. But it was funny because I noticed myself when the other two were talking, like, yeah, like what Nicole was saying, like the yeah, yeah, but because I was like, well, yeah, but you're clearly worthwhile. But see me, let me tell you something about me. So, but it was funny because, again, it was just like this, like, not doing that, not calling myself out to, engage with that. Like, there was a part that was trying to do that, but there's still that part that's like, yeah, but that's not safe to, engage that way, because if you start to engage, they're going to see that you're actually worthless. And so there's that part of me that wants to, yeah, but obviously it's worse for me. And I just found that interesting because it came in the way, like Nicole was talking about, with the diversity things and engaging with people around us, that I noticed that's something that's up for me a lot when I encounter those situations, is like I'm trying to convince myself that I'm worthwhile enough to engage with this person, but when I don't engage, it gives them a mixed message, like you were saying. Like, it's like, for them, I just turned away and walked away. And for me, I'm like, oh, they're going to notice. And they're like, well, what the hell? I'm not worth talking to. So anyway, that's that.
Okay. Is there anybody else that wants to share? Okay. So,
I just wanted to say how much I appreciate you sharing your vulnerabilities. And I was sharing with my two partners here that I'm reading a book right now about the antidote for shame and how it's vulnerability and sharing these deep, dark, icky, spooky things that we're, you can't see that part, and saying that out loud to somebody else. You risk, the person's not compassionate, that can be, whoo. But if, most people can relate and they're like, yeah, me too, and that's, and it's like in that, you sharing your stories, it's like that humanness, like, wow, exactly, there's somebody worthwhile, there's somebody smart, there's somebody who really plans great lessons, and is just on it. And I don't know, I just want to say thank you personally for modeling that and also for creating an environment for us to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
And it was difficult to decide to take on this topic, and I have way more things I wanted to say but I didn't say. But I know that the way through vulnerability and all this shame is to just to walk through it as gently as possible. So I did it for myself too. And Common Grounds provides a really good venue to be safe and to be vulnerable and to let us be more open than anywhere else, really, in the Twin Cities. My world's not that big, but around here, it's hard to do that. But, bodies are just so interesting. They have so many elements, and so many of them touch on the issue of shame and being ashamed of ourselves or feeling that we're dirty in some way, that our body is wrong. And so I wanted to end with that because it's, we talked about a certain level of it, but for me, I need help with every physical body function. So I can't go to the bathroom myself, I can't breathe myself, I can't eat myself. So I have to have other people in my body space all the time. And there's no privacy. And that's, that's really difficult. And with most people, there's this very common thing that people say to me sometimes is that they'd rather be dead than disabled. And that's usually because they don't want someone else to have to take them to the bathroom. And so if you think about how much shame there is around body functions that we all do. There's nothing more common than pooping or peeing. You know, like there's nothing that you do more often. Every single one of us does it, I hope. And, you know, it's like very, very should be the easiest thing to talk about, really. But it's not at all appropriate. So we hide a lot of our body needs, our body functions, and so I just want to leave you with that. And then the upside of all this is when I started realizing how important having a sense of belonging is. It's like, it's so important for me to feel I belong. And I can't change the world. I can only change my perception of it, really, and the way that I relate to myself in it. But if you have a Dharma friend and you're working on accepting them and loving them, but you're helping them to be in their body. And so as we're on common ground, you know, we all feel safer if we have no judgments or if we notice our judgments and don't act on them and blindly believe, oh, that's a black person, or oh, that's an older person, or oh, that's a child, what are they doing here? You know, all the little things that went through our head. If we can watch those in community and realize that we're helping each other feel safe in our bodies by just being bodies here and not trying to be something else. So I have my last quote. It's from this essay that I forgot to write down what it was called. But it's from Darlene Cohen. And she says, healing yourself is just like living your life. It is not a preparation for anything else, nor a journey to another situation called wellness. It is its own self. It has its own value. You live your life to express your own sincerity and your own nature. So, do remember that. And thank you, everyone, for coming. There's a little bit of time left on the Cat Festival. Close till 10. Videos in the park of cats on the internet.
I just want to say, oh, sorry. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Yeah.
My name's Nancy. I was hosting tonight. I just have a couple things that you're interested in, and that we have other guest teachers coming up here. Jean Haley will be speaking this Saturday. Actually, she's leading a workshop on learning to live with Vedana, and Vedana is feelings. It's Saturday, and it is not a full day. It is 9:30 to 2 o'clock. And then the following weekend, August 21st to the 23rd, we have Arina Wiseman is going to be here for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and a few programs worthy to look into, perhaps, if you're interested in this topic of reaching across lines of difference. And I'll just let you do that on your own. There's a few different programs, Friday night guest talk. Saturday, the full workshop with her, you do have to register for. And then Sunday, there is a community conversation that is 1:30 to 4:30 on Sunday. And then finally, I'll just mention that you may or may not know, but Common Ground and all of the programs here are offered in the spirit of generosity, and that this long-held tradition, that it gives us an opportunity to support our wonderful teachers, all these different voices that come here, and bring this wonderful gift that Nicole has given us tonight. So if you wish, if you feel like this matters to me and I want to give back and I want to support her, as a guest teacher, if you wish to leave a donation, there's a bowl in the lobby that Nicole will receive a part of that, and part of it will also go to support Common Ground. So part, I think, of understanding that we don't give any suggested donations or anything, that you should give the amount that really makes you happy. I think that's a good guideline. no amount is too small or too large, and if that helps, which it probably doesn't. But again, thank you so much, as Nicole mentioned, coming here on a beautiful night. Thanks so much.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.